Hey, Noah.
Hey, Ross.
How are you?
I'm okay. Keeping cool.
Keeping cool. Is it as hot in New York as it is here?
I think so. Yeah, we get, it's been pretty brutal. It was over 100. Not today, but yesterday. Today it's over 90.
Conservative support for a carbon tax has risen about 75% on the East Coast in the last...
Do you think so?
Last week. No, I don't think so, actually. nope, not at all. Anyway, so getting ahead of ourselves, I'm Ross Douthat. I'm a columnist for the New York Times, and I am here with...
Noah Millman, and I'm a blogger at The American Scene.
And we are going to talk today about foreign policy and Hollywood, which are both subjects of grave import.
And difficult to distinguish from one another.
So I thought we could start by talking a little bit about Afghanistan, because you and I have had sort of one of these bloggy back and forths a little bit over the past couple weeks. I guess following the McChrystal firing and then following a column that I wrote that basically tried to make the case that that the most likely – it was sort of making the case against the most likely exit strategy from Afghanistan,
right,
by arguing that it wasn't really an exit strategy at all, and that we were in danger of basically – you know, in the name of quote-unquote withdrawal, sort of settling in for a permanent occupation, albeit one with a more sustainable occupation, one with lower American casualties, if not necessarily lower Afghan casualties, but one that would sort of keep us sitting
right
in Kabul for the next 25 years. But one of the things I did in this column, which you objected to, and maybe we can talk about, is I framed this around what I called in a subsequent blog post the options on the table, which is to say that part of the frame of my column was that trying to look at basically what the strategic choices in Afghanistan that seem to be realistically being considered by senior policymakers.
Right.
And that basically excluded the option of a sort of grand recalibration of our posture in the region and a swift and speedy and more or less complete withdrawal, which, as far as I can tell, and, you know, I'm sort of several degrees removed, obviously, from these debates, but as far as I can tell, nobody really in either political party is strongly considering, you know, it's not something that's really being mapped out as a realistic American policy course.
If you're several steps
removed, right, you're right. We'll set aside the degrees removed. But why don't you? I mean, let's talk a little about maybe that issue and the question of whether we should be considering, complete withdrawal.
Or I would phrase it a little bit differently. Rather than should we be considering a complete withdrawal, should we be thinking outside of the frame that or what's common to the two options that you think are seriously being considered?
Right.
Because I don't think there's only two or three. I think there's a whole spectrum of possible ways to approach our presence there. And what I think, if I can articulate what I think you see the two options as, you know, one is our current counterinsurgency strategy, which
right
is increase the troop presence there and work to strengthen the hand of the central government and the effectiveness of the central government and inflict sufficient losses on the Taliban to the point where they want to negotiate something that is relatively favorable to the current government, and we don't worry about the Taliban marching into Kabul. And at that point, we say, okay, some kind of agreement has been reached, and we know that our friends are going to be in a reasonable position, and we leave relatively expeditiously at that point. The alternative is a kind of, you know, counterterrorism plus strategy where we focus on Al-Qaeda and those elements in the Taliban that we view as sort of irreconcilable to living at peace with us and our allies or what have you. And we basically attack them from the greatest distance that we can, keep a light footprint in the country, but stay nearby, whether nearby means in Kabul or means offshore or means in Uzbekistan or means whatever,
right,
so that we're able to act expeditiously and continuously against whoever we identify as the bad guys and let the institutions take care of themselves as well as they can, right? And your argument is basically the latter strategy is going to keep us there longer, isn't going to actually succeed, and is the only real alternative to the counterinsurgency strategy. So even if the counterinsurgency strategy in absolute terms is unlikely to succeed, it's a better bet than the latter, than the other strategy, in terms of possibly succeeding and also in terms of possibly getting us out.
Yes, I mean, that, I think that's fair. The one thing I would say is that as far as I can tell, the option of really fighting from offshore in Afghanistan, you know, whether from Uzbekistan or from ships in the Indian Ocean and so on, that too isn't really, that's sort of excluded from my options on the table analysis. As far as I can tell, everybody in sort of senior policy making positions and sort of who's participating in this debate on a high level is looking at keeping troops in country.
Right.
And the one sort of, and I mean, part of that I think reflects what sort of a secondary point or maybe a primary point of this debate, which is that to some extent the plausibility of the counterterrorism plus strategy depends upon some kind of in-country presence, because you are essentially trying to, you know, use local intelligence to launch launch special forces raids and airstrikes from a great distance. You can't get that local intelligence flat out without some kind of in-country presence. Even, and this is true, even or so people have argued to me, even though, yes, you know, maybe the airstrikes we're launching and the special forces raids we're launching are taking place in Pakistan,
right,
it's still the case that we have a better chance of getting the intel for that with an Afghanistan presence than we do by, you know, working through Pakistan's military and Pakistan's intelligence and so on. So
right.
that's the caveat I would throw in.
Fair enough. So I guess what I would say in response to that dichotomy, like these are the two options on the table and one's not likely to succeed and the other's maybe also unlikely to succeed but more likely and also more likely to lead to an actual exit one way or the other. I'd make a few responses to that and did in sort of our back and forth in print. But the first thing I'd say is there isn't an agreement on sort of what our actual goals are,
right,
then it's very difficult to, you know, say whether those two options should be the only options on the table. And so you have to start the question with what are we actually trying to achieve here, or what do we really need to achieve here? And the other thing I'd say is that the commonality between the two strategies on the table is that they sort of presume our ability to be decisive one way or another. So in the first case, decisive in kind of achieving a certain political end within the country.
Right.
And in the second case, decisive in terms of achieving a certain military end. You know, we can shape events. And I don't think there's a lot of evidence that that's been the case particularly. And it seems less likely going forward than it probably was immediately after the invasion that we could decisively shape events in the country. You know, the big question that I have about both strategies, right, is that the regional actor with the ability to decisively shape events is probably Pakistan. And neither of them starts from the proposition, sort of from the question, well, what does Pakistan want and can we accommodate that, right? And that seems to me the most important question, right? If we're operating, if our goals and Pakistan's goals are diametrically opposed, right, then we're in one position. If our goals and Pakistan's goals are relatively compatible, then we're in a very, very different position and we can consider very different options. And it seems to me that if our goal is keeping Al-Qaeda from regaining its position in Afghanistan, then while our goals and Pakistan's goals aren't the same, they're not obviously incompatible, right? And whereas if our goal is making sure that the Pashtuns don't dominate Afghanistan in the future, right, or that the Taliban is never allowed to re-enter power or not allowed to, or that Pakistan is not allowed to have a dominant role in Afghanistan, then our goals are diametrically opposed, right? For example, if our goal is to ultimately keep al-Qaeda out of there, and we don't really care as much whether the Taliban regains substantially more influence, you know, than it has now and reenters government in some form or another, right? Then what, it's not obvious why our primary objective, our primary strategy right now should be pushing our forces into the areas where the Taliban is most popular, right? Our goal should be to try to buy those people off and focus our efforts within the country on areas where we're most popular, right? And making sure that, you know, that those don't look like easy pickings for the Taliban to reconquer. That would be, it would seem to me, more conducive to an end state of some kind of negotiated settlement. The way we would talk to Pakistan would be somewhat different if we were basically considered their goals acceptable. And I don't honestly know the answer to that. I'm not sure that anybody in Washington really knows the answer to that. I think a lot of people assume that on the one hand, Pakistan is totally unreliable and is an enemy, and on the other hand, there are a lot of people who assume that we have a common enemy in al-Qaeda, and I'm not sure either of those things are exactly true. I think Pakistan or the Pakistani army has its own interests, and the discussion of what we're trying to achieve in Afghanistan should start from an enumeration of those interests and trying to figure out how our interests and their interests can be best reconciled.
Yeah, I mean, I think one possible way of looking at it is that Pakistan's interest in Afghanistan, right, is the same interest it's always had, which is essentially protecting its flank and preventing its regional rivals from gaining the upper hand in a neighboring country. And this is the role that, you know, Pakistan, well, and at the same time, arguably providing an outlet for some of the religious extremism that the Pakistani
right.
intelligence forces stoke in their ongoing conflict with India. Right.
And to some extent, they used Afghanistan, I think, as a training camp for some of these people.
There are a lot of layers there. I mean, and so one argument you could make is that, you know, the extent to which the central power, the Kabul government in Afghanistan, seems like a plausible government as opposed to something that, you know, will either totter and fall over the instant American troops leave, or, as Pakistanis fear, will become a cat's paw for India the instant U.S. forces leave. To the extent that the central government seems like a plausible actor in its own right, you can imagine a diminution of, I mean, you know, Pakistan's playing this double game where they're, you know, they don't like the Pakistani Taliban, but they like the Afghan Taliban, right? And Pakistan has to be aware that there's, you know, potentially major blowback for them in the long run from supporting a sort of religious extremist insurgency in a neighboring country, even as they're trying to fight a related insurgency in their own country.
Right.
So the argument here is that to the extent that you strengthen the hand, and obviously there are real problems with the hand of Hamid Karzai, but to the extent that you strengthen that hand, you weaken Pakistan's incentives to be so all in with the Taliban qua Taliban. Part of the problem, obviously, is that there's the Taliban, and then there's the Taliban's allies, and then there's the Taliban's allies, and
right.
so on. All of this overlaid across the sort of broader issue of sort of Pashtun.
Right, and there's cross currents within the Taliban itself, right? There are groups that are more determined to conquer the country and groups that are less determined to do so and be willing to share power. There are also groups that are more susceptible to being effectively run by the ISI and groups that are less susceptible. There's four quadrants, and there's probably, you know, multiple other dimensions you could, you know, divide all of these groups. The odds that we're able to decisively manipulate that matrix strike me as relatively low. So if we're enumerating sort of the various different options that could be on the table, right, you know, one of the options that could be on the table is, well, let's strengthen the central government's hand in the places where it's naturally strong and ignore the places where it's naturally weak, which is not what we're doing now and not what, you know, our counterinsurgency
right.
plan is.
It's sort of what we were doing during what are regarded as the lost years of the Bush administration.
Right.
I mean, this was sort of...
I guess I'm sort of throwing that out there as an option because, you know, what the counterinsurgency strategy is premised on is you can inflict sufficient losses on the Taliban where they're most popular that they will decide, okay, we can't win this, you know, in a specific time frame, right? And that just strikes me as a strategy without a whole lot of, you know, good precedent for it. You know, the big precedent that people are citing for what we're doing now in Afghanistan is what we did in Iraq,
right?
But Iraq was a very, very different situation, and also what we settled for in Iraq is what is in many ways what we're trying not to settle for in Afghanistan, right? If you look at Iraq, right, the dominant group in the country is dominating the country. Right, and what we're trying to achieve in Afghanistan is a situation where the dominant group is not dominating the country. What we settled for in Iraq is that the dominant political force is fairly friendly with the strongest neighboring country, with Iran.
Right.
Right. And what we're trying to avoid in Afghanistan is exactly that: the group that is most friendly with the dominant neighboring country, Pakistan, winds up dominating the country. So we're aiming for something very, very different. So I don't, you know, just on a political level, I don't feel like there's a very good, there's a particularly good analogy there. The other main thing that I would say is a lot of what the discussion has been about from your columns has been kind of gaming ourselves, right? Like, okay, well, these are the options on the table because this is all we can think about. This is all we can tolerate. And I just wonder whether that's sort of the right role of people like us to play, you know, is sort of saying, okay, well, this is who we are and this is the space that we have to live in because this is our own internal political reality, right? That's the thing that we have the most control over, right? We have a lot less control over political reality in Pakistan and Afghanistan than we have over political reality in the United States, right? And columnists in the New York Times have a lot of influence to the extent that anyone in the media does.
To the extent that anyone in the media does.
Right.
I mean, I appreciate the compliment. I mean, I think one of the reasons that I wrote the column the way I did was that I saw the debate in Afghanistan over Afghanistan taking on this cast where the anti-war option was being, or the sort of Joe Biden plan was being defined as I think America has a sort of, you know, intense domestic constituency for doing something much more outside the box, much more mm-hmm. outside, I mean, trying to strengthen the central government in the regions where it's strongest, but just getting the hell out of Afghanistan. That constituency, I think, has sort of allied itself with voices in the elite debate who see the goal not as withdrawal, but as a kind of sustainable presence in mm-hmm. Afghanistan. So in that sense, I mean, yeah, I think that was what I was trying to essentially point out in the column. I mean, I think that I'm, you know, part of, well, I suppose I would, you know, there are a number of things that make me more, not necessarily more optimistic about the success of counterinsurgency as a strategy, but more compelled to the sense that it should be tried than I think you are, some of which we haven't touched on at all in the course of the exchange. One of which is just sort of a moral argument about mm-hmm. what we owe the people of Afghanistan to some extent in terms of what we do with our military presence there.
Right.
But That being said, I think that, you know, there is a moment where I would write a column for the New York Times advocating advocating a much more comprehensive recalibration in Afghanistan. I haven't reached that moment yet. I'm not ready to give up on the current strategy. And yeah, I mean, and part of it is, I think that people make many, many good points about the sort of incompatibilities between the landscape in Iraq and the landscape in Afghanistan and so on. But many of the arguments, you know, the specifics of the arguments are different, but the frame of the arguments is somewhat similar, I think, in terms of, you know, how people are talking about the limits of what we can do in Afghanistan versus how people were talking about the limits of what we could do in Iraq. And I probably am conditioned, by the way. I mean, I'm somebody who thinks that the surge was, an enormous success, and it was an enormous success for all kinds of reasons that had nothing to do with sort of military achievements and so on. But I think that there's a big tendency, particularly in the blogosphere, probably more than in the world of op-ed columns, to sort of talk about the limits of the surge. And the limits of the surge are, you know, enormous and real and all the rest of it. And there were goals that we set out when we embarked on the surge that we haven't come close to meeting and probably will never be met. But just in terms of, you know, I mean, this sort of state of life in Iraq, I think that the experience of what sort of, you know, I mean, this is, I think this can sound like a naive way to talk about, military efforts, but there is a sense in which, you know, in Iraq we invaded a country and occupied a country and occupied it badly for the space of years and years and years and presided over a steadily mounting humanitarian disaster. Mm-hmm. And at the moment, you know, at the moment when the surge was being debated, the alternative strategy on the table, as I say, was a sort of Iraqi version of counterinsurgency plus. It was the, Baker-Hamilton plan for essentially trying to sort of ease our way to the exit, sort of try and, you know, prevent, mitigate the damage and so on. And in hindsight, that looks like, to me, like a terrible strategy, and a strategy that would have cost, you know, whatever it would have cost us, it would have cost Iraq enormously in lives and long-term consequences and so on. And it's hard, you know, and this may be one of the ironies of history that we always learn the wrong lessons, but looking at Afghanistan and looking at, you know, a military leadership that for all the sort of, you know, for all the stuff in the McChrystal Rolling Stone article about, you know, people talking about how the strategy isn't working and so on, you don't have anything. I mean, obviously some of this is just because you could say that Petraeus and his counterinsurgency gurus have just sort of taken over the military. But I think there is a reasonable level of confidence in the military, as far as I can tell, that it's still possible to achieve some things militarily in Afghanistan for the long term, and it's hard for me to sort of shake the sense that that is worth at least, you know, trying, particularly since it's so clear that, you know, that this is not going to be an open-ended commitment, right? I mean, there isn't any way we're going to be surging in Afghanistan for the next 15 years. There just isn't.
Well, nor was there the expectation of, or the possibility that we would do that in Iraq. I don't disagree that the situation in Iraq is substantially, on the ground, is vastly better than it was before the surge, or that, you know, and I don't disagree that sort of Petraeus' strategy has a lot to do with that. But I guess what I would say, apart from sort of pointing out the differences in the situations, is just that, you know, sort of the big component that you don't mention of what changed with Petraeus' appointment is really what our political goals were in Iraq. And as I said before, we settled for something that, you know, earlier on was considered by us to be utterly unacceptable. If Petraeus comes in and says basically, you know, officially, you know, here I am to win with the existing strategy, but in effect what he does is substantially change that strategy so that, we're much less aiming at what McChrystal was aiming at, right? We're much less aiming at crippling the Taliban in the areas where it's strongest, you know, but he manages to convince us that he's won the war we were trying to fight, you know, then he's managed his
he's managed
the political electorate in the United States very well, and maybe he'll have managed the actors in the region very well, right? You know, I'm willing to give, you know, Petraeus a great deal of credit as a military politician, right? As somebody who understands the motivations of the different actors in these situations, both at home and in the field.
But that's a very
different thing from saying, you know, okay, what we need to do is achieve some kind of decisive breakthrough. And even if the Obama administration kind of, for political reasons or whatever, can't say outright, you know, we've got to recalibrate what our goals are pretty dramatically. And he said that to a certain extent already. You know, people out here in columnist and blog land certainly can.
Right, but I think, don't you think that to some extent that's already been said and is already, I mean, it's already pretty clear that even if it isn't the formal policy of the United States government, it's pretty clear that we are open to negotiation with at least some elements of the insurgency at this point. And from what you hear sort of under the radar, we're, you know, well, maybe a little bit more open than I think we should be at this point, given how weak our strategic hands or our military hand seems to be right now. I mean, I think there is already a sense of the goalpost shifting and so on. And part of it, too, is that I think American conservatives, the American right, is much less invested in an idea of sort of final victory here than they were in Iraq. I mean, you know, the Weekly Standard may run editorials that sort of use similar language to the Iraq War, but
why do you think that is, by the way? I mean, is that purely a kind of, okay, Obama owns this war and therefore it's okay to oppose it, or is it an actual
Among conservatives in general?
Yeah, why is it acceptable to at least think, we don't have to quote unquote achieve victory here, or is it true, or is it simply again a redefinition of what victory is to something that, you know, that lines up with, you know,
I mean it's a combination of something bad and something good. The bad thing is sort of a natural partisanship that sets in that you saw in Michael Steele's comments, where once the other party's in the White House and they have ownership of a military conflict, you're less inclined probably to, you know, necessarily see sort of victory in that conflict as a vindication of your side and so on. But I also think that there is sort of, you know, there's a reasonable sense, I think, among a lot of American conservatives that recognizes that strategically Iraq was, you know, whatever you think of the initial decision to invade, Iraq was a more strategically important country than Afghanistan, and the, you know, the sort of what we wanted to gain in Iraq was therefore understandably larger than what we wanted to gain in Afghanistan. I mean, I think you would see a different, I think though a lot of, I mean, again, it depends on what, you know, what the options on the table are and what,
there's,
you know,
that table again.
There's that, sorry, but what, you know, what's being considered and so on. I mean, I think that a lot of American conservatives are drawn I think on the American left, you have a lot of people who just want to get out.
Right.
I think on the sort of increasingly skeptical about the war American right, you have a lot of people who would be happy dialing it down to sort of counterinsurgency or
right.
counterterrorism plus, but who would be, you know, who would be, you know, horrified if the Taliban marched back into Kabul. You know, I
right.
mean, I think that that's sort of...
So if I can opine a little bit, I think sort of the piece of it... The other piece that I'd put in sort of what the mindset is there is again, this sort of, you know, very strong desire to be in control of events, right? So the nice thing...
A recurring American problem.
Well, yeah, and the nice... Well, it's only a problem if you decide to try to control events that you can't control, right? There are a lot of things that are within our control, right? But that, I think, is part of the visceral appeal of something like a counterterrorism, you know, plus strategy is, you know, we're back in charge, right? We don't need, you know, Karzai. We don't need Pakistan's approval. We don't need anybody telling us what to do and constraining us. You know, we can, we'll just go and kill the guys we need to kill.
Right.
And I think that operates on an emotional level. And so when the surge was being contemplated in Iraq, the sort of alternative, right, didn't sort of fit in that emotional space. There was no one standing around saying, well, what we should do is just, you know,
just
bomb
kill the
bad
guys
from the air, you know, and that wasn't what the debate was about. So I think that's another important component to that.
Well, and there is also the extent to which, you know, Iraq, the fact that Afghanistan was a nonpartisan war to begin with,
right,
just means, you know, everybody was identified with it, which means that nobody was identified with it that strongly, whereas the Iraq war became, you know, if you were on the right, it was a sort of totemic sign of your support for the Bush administration and your, you know, hatred for the cut-and-run perfidy of liberals and so on. And so
all of that suggests that there isn't a real foreign policy rethinking of any kind going on. Right. In other words, if Iraq is still to some extent that totem, right, and if opposition to Afghanistan, to Obama's plans in Afghanistan is sort of, you know, one part partisanship and one part fatigue and one part, you know, sort of a desire to be just sort of in control of things and not, you know, then, you know, it sounds to me like there isn't, you know, kind of an alternative view to how to handle the region.
I don't think that there is. Well, I mean, I think the alternative, yeah, to the extent there is an alternative view among conservative intellectuals, it is the sort of, you know, I mean, what George Will has championed is probably a more offshore version of counterterrorism plus and so on. And so you know, to some extent, there is that alternative view is sort of an end to, you know, no more occupations, no more nation building. We're just going to kill terrorists and so on. Which is sort of, I mean, to use Walter Russell Mead's overused typologies, it's the reassertion of the Jacksonian element on the American right as opposed to the...
I like Walter Russell Mead's, you know.
We talked about this a long time ago.
Yeah.
But you know, it admits of all kinds of weaknesses, but it's a very useful typology, I think. And, I mean, I think that part of... What you haven't seen, I think, on the right, is any kind of sustained reassertion of the kind of, you know, sort of. I mean, George Will sort of embodies this, but a kind of realist, you could call it in the Hamiltonianism in the Mead typology. You still have a sort of, you know, the Jacksonians on the one hand, sort of Wilsonians or hard Wilsonians on the other, arguing about how we should fight and so on. There isn't, and you can see this in other areas where, you know, if you look at the debate over how we should deal with Russia, right? I mean, there isn't really a particularly strong constituency on the right arguing that we should treat with Russia as a, you know, sort of rival great power rather than as a, you know, evil Russian bear to be either contained or defeated.
Which seemed like sort of that image of Russia seems to have almost no relationship to Russia's place in the world today, right? I mean, Russia retains a large nuclear arsenal and therefore kind of swings more weight in the world than it would otherwise, you know, but its economy is relatively small, its military is sort of rusting and falling apart, right? The sort of foreign policy aims that Russia has are mostly to make sure that, you know, the countries right on its borders are, you know, relatively, you know, pliant. And the countries right on its borders are countries that, you know, a couple of decades ago were part of it.
Right.
You know, so it's sort of like what's the reason, right, for that kind of view of Russia? Why is there any view of Russia at all as part of sort of the right's constellation?
Well, there are two things. I mean, I guess you could do the Jacksonian hard Wilsonian thing again, right? There's the hard Wilsonians on the right, which is sort of neoconservatives, John McCain and so on.
Right, right.
For whom, you know, America has sort of, we pushed our sphere of democratic influence all the way to Russia's borders, and that's a good thing. And, you know, democracies on Russia's borders are great things, and we need to defend them. And then there's the Jacksonian.
This is on the assumption that, like, Ukraine and, you know, Georgia and places like that are, you know, sort of strong pro-Western democracies as opposed
right.
to something a little bit more mushy and
yes.
debatable. Right?
Well, or that they're on their way to becoming strong pro-Western democracies and that we should be, you know, smoothing that process along. And if we don't smooth that process along, authoritarianism will reassert itself. I mean, this isn't just on, you know, you get this from Fred Hyatt's column recently in the Washington Post about sort of, I mean, it's sort of, it's, some of this is like Russia, the Russian near abroad as a leading indicator of a larger turn towards authoritarianism. I think that plays into. And but then you have also the Jacksonian side, which is more, I think, invested in like debates over missile defense and the START Treaty, which thinks like, you know, why are we basically...
Why ever give any?
Right. It's not so much
right.
that, like, they're worried about, you know, Russia nuking us. It's that, yeah, why are we giving anything instead of, you know, sort of sticking it to the Russian bear and so
right.
on. And that
but
is
those...
what you basically got in Mitt Romney's
right.
Op-ed arguing that the START Treaty was the worst mistake of Obama's
right.
presidency.
I mean, the
worst foreign policy mistake. The worst domestic policy mistake was obviously supporting Mitt Romney's health care plan.
Right. what's notable, just sort of stepping back several paces, like, as long as those two perspectives dominate, you know, the right in the United States,
yeah.
right, it's worth noting that they're radically incompatible perspectives on the world, right? So, like, if your point of view is, you know, the United States is, you know, the champion of freedom around the world and needs to be sort of in the vanguard and making sure we're siding with, you know, truth, justice, and things that approximate the American way
right.
wherever they show up, then we're also going to be deeply involved in the rest of the world and we need to sort of, you know, understand the dynamics within each of these different places, and we can't, and we will necessarily wind up making compromises and trade-offs of our own interests in order to secure, you know, unless you take a sort of really sort of radically naive view of the world that, you know, sort of doing what's, you know, what maximizes U.S. power and maximizes U.S. interests always is exactly what advances all of these various other causes that we want to align ourselves with, there's going to be, you know, trade-offs there, you know, and so sort of the point of view that says why ever give anything, and you know, why not always take the toughest line on all matters is completely incompatible with a viewpoint that the United States needs to be sort of the global leader of the march of democracy.
Yes. However, I don't think they're any more incompatible than the sort of two competing strains in liberal foreign policy. I mean, I think you could make the same argument about the sort of fundamental incompatibility of a kind of liberal internationalism, which sees the United States as a, you know, a not a domineering tyrannical power, but a sort of leading power in the building of a stable, peaceful, global order of, you know, successful multinational organizations, and the more sort of radical, sometimes quasi-pacifist, sometimes non-interventionist, sometimes straightforwardly anti-American, I don't mean that pejoratively, I mean sort of...
Distrustful of American actions.
Right,
yeah,
I mean the sort of that left, I think, those are in certain ways as incompatible. I mean, I think on the right, what, you know, if you look at the successful Republican foreign policy administrations, right, I think in hindsight, both the Reagan administration and George H.W. Bush's administration look remarkably successful in the run of, you know, judged against other American presidencies. What happened?
Yeah, you probably have to go back to Eisenhower for...
Right,
know,
who also, right, where there was actually, I think, a similar dynamic to what I'm about. I mean, I think in all of those cases, you had at the elite level, you had a sort of, you had a kind of wise man-ish realism sort of mediating between the sort of Jacksonian and hard Wilsonian aspects of Republican foreign policy, of conservative sentiment, I guess. And where I'm sort of, where I try not to get too pessimistic about the right in foreign policy is that I don't think there's never been and never will be a deep popular constituency for foreign policy realism on either the left or the right. And I think what you hope for is not that suddenly there's a mass movement for sensible realism in American foreign policy. It's that you elect a Republican president who, you know, understands the world well enough to recognize the need to sort of mediate between these different factions and not just go off half-cocked.
Yeah, I think that's true. I don't think there will... I sort of question the degree to which, you know, genuine mass movements ever exist on either side.
Fair.
But I have a very elitist view of the way political history works. But I guess what I would say is I don't know that what foreign policy has become I think it's more on the right now than it is on the left. I think it was more on the left in the 70s and especially in the 80s.
Mm-hmm.
Is a kind of a proxy for, you know, a certain kind of identity politics, right? It's a way, it's a sort of, you know, tribal flag waving thing. This is, you know, if you make arguments of a certain form, you know, then we know, you know, and if you, you know, say
right.
certain kinds of phrases,
if
then
you
we know
you attack
you're a
Obama
member of the
for shaking hands with Hugo Chavez, we know.
Right.
Right. Yeah.
It's, and like the substance is idiotic and is actually kind of irrelevant. Like the point is you're saying, you know, I'm the real American. He's not, you know. And I guess the trouble on the right is, I mean, you have crazies on all sides of the political spectrum. I think the problem with respect to foreign policy on the political right is that, and it's probably not only with respect to foreign policy, but it's notable there precisely because there's no genuine reason at all why it would be, you know, and Russia's a great example, right? There's just nothing in the substance of these discussions that could possibly be relevant to anybody, you know, engaged in these debates. But the kind of flag waving winds up, you know, completely eclipsing any genuine sort of debate about, you know, priorities or how we should approach it. And there's not a dynamic where sort of what you'd want is some other emotional dynamics entering the picture, right? I don't expect, you know, primary campaigns or anything like that to hinge on, you know, people actually figuring out what everyone's different plan is for this or that foreign policy problem, among other things, because all of those plans will be thrown out the window as soon as, you
right.
know, the next crisis happens. But that sort of the emotional tone of what's looked for encompasses other parts of the spectrum than just, you know, prove to me that you're, you know that you're a red meat American. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You know,
well,
if somebody who stood up and said, you know, who ran as, you know, I'm a George H.W. Bush, you know, Republican, I want things to be, I want our foreign policy to be managed really well. You know, I admire Eisenhower because he managed everything really well. I think that wouldn't get a lot of traction.
No, that probably wouldn't get a lot of traction. But on the other hand, I mean, you know, Eisenhower didn't run for president exactly as an Eisenhower Republican. he ran. No, I mean, well, I mean,
right,
he did to some extent.
In,
but if
in,
you go back
fun,
and you know,
yeah.
I mean, he ran. I mean, this was obviously a very, very different time. But he ran in the grand Bob Dole tradition of being against Democrat wars, right?
Right.
I mean,
right.
But
well, and I think simultaneously, kind of mocked Stevenson as being sort of an egghead in
right,
the
right.
world.
Right,
yeah.
But I mean, you know, Reagan certainly, you know, in the late 70s was not campaigning as a kind of, you know, vote for me because I will talk like a, you know, talk like a super hawk, but, you know, basically govern like Eisenhower. And it may be that in Reagan's case, you know, that was something that he sort of came to consciously later once he was into his presidency. But I mean, I think what you can hope for, though, is a sense, you know, to the extent that the combination of anxiety over America's long-term fiscal position and weariness with, you know, nation-building exercises and so on, to the extent that those two trends converge on the right, I think you can imagine candidates. I think you can imagine candidates running a little bit like George W. Bush did in 2000. Critique quickly. You gave it in the blog post. We'll link to it. But give me your critique quickly of where Pixar has gone wrong.
Pixar has gone wrong because the guys at Pixar are like, what's his name? It's the Steve Carell character in the 40-Year-Old Virgin with his, you know, toys in there, you know, with his $6 million man action figure. They've gone sort of off the deep end with a kind of sort of adult sentimentality that I don't think particularly speaks to children and that I don't think is actually good for grown-up movies either. You know, I don't think they're doing, you know, they've said a few times, we're making movies for grown-ups, we're not really making movies for children, although they're appropriate for children. But I think they're making movies to a very particular sensibility that it's doing damage to the quality of the art that they're producing. That's my short
take. That's your short take, yeah. I have not seen Toy Story 3. But your...
What did you think of Up? Did you love Up? Did you hate Up?
I liked Up. I haven't loved a Pixar movie since The Incredibles.
Okay.
I really didn't like Ratatouille.
I enjoyed Ratatouille.
Yeah.
It had problems, but I enjoyed it.
But not exactly for the reasons you're describing. I mean, I think that what I disliked about Ratatouille was the fact that I found none of the characters the least bit sympathetic.
Not even Remy?
No, I didn't find. Well, I think
oh,
I think the core. I think it's. I had a whole critique, and now it's. That I wrote in a review and has now slipped my mind. It's been so long since I've seen it, and I didn't like it, so I didn't see it again. But as I recall, I felt like the Remy and the human character who, you know, had the love interest and so on, the sushi
yeah, that was
and so
great.
On, I felt like they, it's, you know, Remy was one piece of a sympathetic protagonist, and the human character was another less sympathetic piece of a sympathetic protagonist, but together they didn't actually add up to a sympathetic protagonist.
Yeah, the story of Ratatouille is the
story of
Antonio,
right. Of the,
well, it's the artist and the
right.
critic, right? And Remy's the artist and Ego's the
right.
critic, and all the other humans are really not the story, except as kind of a canvas for the artist to sort of play
right.
out his thing.
And I guess I would, yeah. So I guess my critique was that I didn't think that this story of the artist and the critic, at least as expressed there, was enough to hang the movie on. And then I just thought that, you know, even if you make that point, it's still the case that, you know, it matters what your secondary characters are like in a movie.
Yeah.
And, like, you know, the villain was stupid, the love
right.
interest was weak, and so, yeah, so I didn't think that highly
right. I don't really disagree with those criticisms.
And then I guess to your broader point, I think what would be, you know, what could be said in defense of Pixar is that place where sort of adult sentimentality meets movies for children and so on is a place that can get you into a lot of trouble. And I think you're, you know, identifying accurately some of the trouble it gets into. It also, though, could be, you know, potentially a sweet spot where really good for the whole family blockbusters get made. In a sense, and maybe not. I mean, maybe but there.
It's a particular. So
like, I mean, like The Incredibles, right? Is a movie ultimately for, you know, adults. And
yeah.
it is a movie where, you know, I mean, your critique of Up is that it's completely a movie for adults, where the kid is really just along for the ride and sort of
the big problem with Up is that the kid, right? This is a movie about sort of reconnecting on some level, both transcending your childhood and reconnecting with the idea of childhood,
right,
and so forth, right? And living again, right? Instead of living, you know, just in the past, living in the present to a certain, you know, even, you know, after the sort of the burden of the past appears to be crushing, right?
Right?
It's about all this stuff. But the kid, right, is entirely instrumental, doesn't have any character. And I just found that totally unconscionable. It set my teeth on edge all the way through the movie, and made me really kind of doubt the honesty of the movie sort of comprehensively because of that. I say that and then I think about, well, goes, okay, aren't there other movies where, you know, the kids are secondary, you know, and yeah, in The Incredibles, the kids are secondary, but the kids have their own stories, right? Each of the kids in those movies, you can imagine, like, they're secondary characters, but they may think they're the heroes of their own movies, right? You can see that they've got their own identities and their own personalities, and they don't revolve around, you know, the needs of other characters, you know. Or to pick another example of a sort of a kid's movie that's really a grown-up story, Enchanted, which is not a Pixar movie, it's a Disney movie, right? Similarly, like, the kid in that movie is very secondary, but she's got her own personality and her own agenda, right? And you know that she's her own person. You know, she's not just there for the purpose of these other characters. You know, and that just wasn't true of Up, and it bothered me enormously. And that's part of what I mean by sort of the kind of sentimentality they've got is ruining their art, right? They're losing touch with that sense of multiple centers and multiple people and multiple personalities. They're diving into themselves, you know, and winding up with these stories where kind of the story of the guy making the movie, you know, winds up, you know, or the sort of producing the movie, winds up being the driver of the story instead of the different characters being the drivers, and that's a problem.
Do you think that this applies to WALL-E?
I had problems with WALL-E, but I don't think these were the problems I had exactly with WALL-E. I just thought the second half of WALL-E really wasn't very good. I thought WALL-E was definitely a sympathetic protagonist, if that's the word you want to use. I thought WALL-E, the whole section with WALL-E alone was wonderful, and I thought the section of WALL-E taking care of Eve after she goes into hibernation was wonderful. I actually didn't like Eve as a character either. I thought Eve was entirely instrumental.
Eve was not the strongest character in all of fiction. That's definitely true.
Well, it's not just that she wasn't strong, as that there were all sorts of things about her that kind of sort of only made sense. I mean, Eve was sort of the Angelina Jolie character, you know, the sort of the butt-kicking babe with,
yes,
you know,
yep,
you know, and there was no particular reason that that's what she would be for story reasons. It was there because that's what would turn on, you know, the audience. And I sort of bristle at that.
Well, she had to be butt-kicking because she was getting sent out to explore, you know, strange...
An uninhabited planet.
Well, not uninhabited. You never know what you're going to meet on an uninhabited planet.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
She had to have a laser.
Yeah, she had to have a laser.
And she was
so
a little bit trigger happy.
It's
death. True. And the fact that WALL-E managed to survive those initial bursts of laser fire.
But the only reason they're there is so that she can terrify him, right? Like, there's no other story reason for them to be there. And that struck me as, you know, there's sort of a sexual component to that struck me as odd. I mean, not odd in the sense that I haven't seen it before. I see it over and over and over again. But odd for a Pixar film. They're usually above that sort of thing. You know, it's the kind of thing I would expect from DreamWorks.
you talk about it a little bit in reference. And actually, thinking about it, I feel like I buy your critique more of Finding Nemo in a way than I do of Up. And I've seen Finding Nemo a couple times and Up only once, so
I've seen Finding
Nemo. You've
probably
seen it like 57,000 times, right?
Yeah, because I have a 7-year-old at home, and there was a period where it was his favorite movie, so we saw it over and over again. Finding Nemo is problematic. I liked it anyway, and my son liked it. My son did not like Up.
You're just slavishly following the critical views of your son. Don't you
think
that's a part of the problem? I mean, shouldn't you be independent?
He's smarter than I am. He has better taste than I have. He's better looking than me. I want to be like him when I grow up. Nemo has his own arc and his own story. It's just a secondary story. Right.
You know, Nemo
has to find his own independence and his own confidence in himself, independent of his dad. And he does. It's a simple story, and he achieves it, and he does it without his father. And then, you know, he also, you know, because of what his father does, as well as because of what he does, you know, comes to appreciate his father in a way that he didn't before. The bigger story is the dad's story, but I don't think it's very different from The Incredibles in that the center is on the adult. The kid has his.
Yeah, I think maybe for me it was that I found the central character in Up more appealing than I found Albert Brooks's character in Finding Nemo, but.
You would be far from alone in finding the Albert Brooks character, which he plays in every movie that Albert Brooks is in, unappealing. There are plenty of people in your company.
Well, I'm glad I'm not alone. Well, maybe we should leave it there. Unless, do we want to say anything about M. Night Shyamalan? Because you did, you saw The Last Airbender.
I did. Well, again,
you are part of this. What I denounced yesterday, which is the people in America and around the world who are depriving Shyamalan of the immense flop that seems to me like the only thing that can possibly rattle him back into making anything like a decent movie again.
Yeah, I guess I was never a huge fan, so I was never somebody who thought, "Wow, this is a genius." I thought I liked The Sixth Sense, but didn't love it. I liked Unbreakable well enough, but didn't love it. And I kind of lost interest in him after that, because after that he started making movies that got progressively worse notices, and I wasn't crazy about him before that. So, but I kind of agree with a lot of that article you linked to from New York Magazine, that he's just not good at the sort of the mythological, you know, stuff that what he needs to do is make, you know, sort of little movies about people. The trouble is that I don't think he sees that deeply into those people, you know.
The emotions
in Unbreakable are at the comic book level, even though it's a very different emotional palette than a typical comic book, you know. And so that's a problem. You know, where do you find stories that work if your emotional palette is, you know, off to the side of where a typical comic book palette is, but basically still a comic book palette.
And it may be that he found a particular sweet spot with sort of interesting spins on the ghost story, the superhero movie, the alien invasion movie, and so on, that then just re-diminished. You know, he took genres and relied on the genre architecture, tweaked it somewhat.
The big problem with The Last Airbender, right, is more than anything, more than the fact that it's confusing, more than the fact that the fight scenes look terrible, more than the fact that the special effects are stupid, you know, more than the fact that the acting is leaden, you know, the big problem is that there's, I think, one joke in the entire movie. You know, there's just no sense of humor about itself. It's utterly ponderous and self-important. And the cartoon's nothing like that. You know, the cartoon, you know, has, you know, plenty of humor. It doesn't take itself particularly seriously. The protagonist, you know, is much more of a kid with, you know, kind of
a kid's
enthusiasm for just stuff, you know, and things going on, than the Aang of the movie, who's, you know, deadly serious all the time. But that's a Shyamalan problem.
It is.
He doesn't have a sense of humor.
He doesn't, although in Signs, actually, and maybe this is just the fact that he had, you know, Joaquin Phoenix is a really good actor, and he had was Kieran Culkin? I'm not sure, but he had good child actors and so on. But the domestic stuff in Signs before the alien invasion starts, I thought actually worked pretty well in a kind of slightly askew, slightly humorous kind of way. It helps actually that Mel Gibson, now banished forever to the 17th circle of hell, is, which he will undoubtedly find pleasantly masochistic.
Additional circles just for him.
But he is actually not a bad comic actor too. I guess my right. sort of my sympathy for Shyamalan, or you know, the guy who made the first four movies, well, not that he made Praying with Anger and some movies before that, but is related to my sort of, you know, my simultaneous. I like Hollywood blockbusters, and I feel like I've hated the whole superhero era of Hollywood blockbusters. And what I liked about Shyamalan was that he was trying to make sort of mass entertainment, pop entertainment, the kind of thing that I think Hollywood can do well, and ultimately really has to be Hollywood's niche in an age when the sort of 70s auteur spirit has just migrated for good reasons to cable television. And he was trying to operate in what I think should be Hollywood's sweet spot, in the way that I think Pixar tries to do too. I'm sort of loath to, you know, I mean, he was working from original scripts. I mean, he wasn't working with pre-existing properties, anyway, that's probably part of the root. And I talk about this somewhat in the piece I wrote defending him before he made all these really, really horrible movies.
Right.
But anyway, we can...
The loss of a sense of humor, though.
Is it, right. The sense of humor is absolutely crucial to that sort of pop sweet spot. I mean, not in every case. I mean, you can do, but in like
you can do funny, right, in a shallow way, you know, and it's pretty easy to paste it on, and it usually works well enough, but it's not very good. So returning to Pixar for a second, right, sort of part of what's happened with them is that they haven't lost their sense of humor. They throw plenty of jokes into their movies still. But they're pasted on top of a central story that they take deadly seriously, you know, that's just really, really important, you know. And, you know, the fact is what Buzz Lightyear went through and what Woody went through in the first movie, right, which was a whole lot funnier, was a whole lot more serious on a psychological level than what they're going through in the most recent movie. But in the most recent movie, their dilemma is their problem, right, which is purely external, actually, is treated as, you know, a terribly important thing, you know, whereas in the first movie they make fun of Buzz for thinking he's terribly important, right? And that's sort of the most important thing to have a sense of humor about, right, is about what you think is most important, right?
But don't you think that could, too, be just sequelitis? I mean, one of the things Pixar has wisely done in general is avoid sequels to almost any of their movies, and they've made now an exception twice for Toy Story,
yeah.
And you did too, I think,
Toy Story 2 a lot.
But it may just be too that, you know, there's the central drama of the toy only admits of so many variations, and at a certain point you hit a variation that just doesn't work.
Yeah, that may be. We'll see what they do
next.
We
will. I think they'll do something. All right, Noah. Well, it's been a pleasure. I hope our Blogging Heads masters don't mind the fact that this is the longest Blogging Heads I've recorded in a long time.
Well, maybe they'll
cut it
in
half, it'll be like the last Harry Potter movie. All right.
Great talking to you.
Take care.
Take care.